Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, my guest is Anchorage psychologist, our licensed professional counselor, Michelle Martin. She's close to getting a doctorate degree in psychology. Dr. Martin has been in practice for about 6 years here in Anchorage, and she specializes to a large degree on addressing victims and perpetrators of sexual abuse and sexual offenders. Because of the sensitive nature of the program today, you may want to use appropriate judgment in who might be listening to the program, but we are more than happy to take your calls and answer any questions that you've got. Besides talking about the treatment and psychology of sexual offenders, we'll also hopefully, or perhaps I should say, get into the issue of just normal sexuality and children and teaching children about and teens about issues related to sexuality. Michelle, let me just say thanks for agreeing to do this. And it's the first time in the 10 years I've been doing this we've talked about this particular subject, but I think it's one that we need to do.
It is, definitely. Thank you.
All right. You can reach us today with questions or comments. If you're in Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. So how do we get into this? How did you get into being interested in the treatment of sexual offenders?
Well, I'd have to say definitely, you know, attending my master's program at University of Alaska for my my first master's, we were given the opportunity to kind of set up our own practicum and internship sites. And the first thing I thought of, having kind of always wanted to work with criminals, was to contact the folks out there who were doing a treatment program at Highland Mountain Correctional Center before that got shut down, and was very blessed to have been accepted and allowed to kind of initially sit in on groups and then help with individual and group counseling out there with the male sex offenders under the mentorship and supervision of Dr. Martin Atrops. So okay. I started that back in 97, and I haven't really done much else since.
All right. So what I like to do a lot is to make sure we get our definitions and things straight. Sometimes our idea of what we're talking about is much different than the reality. So let's start by somehow defining a sex offender.
So this is the one where people get the image in their head, right, of the right. guy in the trench coat hanging out in the playground.
Well, that's a comic. Yeah. No, that's not a comic. Okay.
But I think that's typically what people think of when they think of a sex offender, is sort of the creepy guy with the, you know, the long unkempt hair and the disheveled look. But the guys that I typically see in my office are anything but. So they can come from a wide range of demographics. Race and ethnicity, and certainly economic status. So it's really hard to say, you know, to pine down exactly what a sex offender is. Someone who's committed a sexual offense, just, you know, here in the state of Alaska can run anywhere from, you know, distribution or viewing of child pornography all the way to sexual assault against a minor or sexual assault against an adult, which typically we call rape.
You mentioned men, but before we came on the air, there are women
sex
offenders?
I do. I work with some women out at a group at Highland Mountain, and then also some women in the community and in some of the villages. We also have juvenile sex offenders, which we try to call youthful sex offenders, because, you know, obviously the issues around them and their treatment is going to be completely different from what you might do with an adult sex offender. So there's usually, you know, you've got the men, the women, and the youthful sex offenders.
When I go to Wikipedia,
always the standard, right? The gold standard.
Somewhere I got to get educated. It says, and this surprises me a little bit. A lot. One of the lines here says, some of the crimes, which usually result in mandatory sex offender classification, are 1, a second prostitution conviction. And then this one gets me: sending or receiving obscene content in a text message, that is sexting. And then also it says relationship between young adults and teenagers resulting in the corruption of a minor. And then any sexual contact between an adult and a minor is by definition sexual molestation. So the sexting bit got my attention, because here I'm thinking, a teenager who sexting or whatever, however you say that, gets caught and somehow ends up in the court system and gets prosecuted, then would they have to be put on the sex offender list? So tell me more
about
all that.
Sure. Okay. So, you know, if we – this is not something I typically see or haven't typically seen in Alaska. Obviously, every state has different rules and regulations, and some are stricter than others. And we have juvenile sex offender registries in other states, I think up to 47 states now, under the Adam Walsh Act. So we, as in Alaska, do not have this. But, you know, we're talking about kids sending or receiving maybe naked pictures of their girlfriends, naked pictures of their boyfriends, sort of inappropriate, developmentally inappropriate, maybe discussions that they're having on their little smartphones back and forth. And sometimes that can be used to be harmful against a person. You know, these people break up. The boyfriend goes and shows all his friends. He's thinking that this was a great sexual exploit. The girl was thinking that there was some emotional connection there and that, you know, she trusted this boy and things like that. So we can kind of see where maybe looking at what the difference might be between a sexual offending issue and a sexual boundary issue kind of can come into play there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so kind of working with kids in terms of teaching them sexual boundaries as opposed to saying, you know, what you're doing right here is mm-hmm. a sexual offense. But in the state of Alaska, we don't have a juvenile registry. So if they were to get in trouble for something like sexting, they wouldn't necessarily go on a registry. They would be classified as a sex offender, but then that would be sealed once they turned 18, unless they committed a similar offense or another sex mm-hmm. offense as an adult. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. So what does it take to get on the registries then? I am really naive about this. I know they exist. My gestalt feeling is I'm not sure that they're as good as maybe the general public thinks. I think there's a lot of potential harm here, but I don't know. So let's talk about registries.
Sure.
A little bit.
You know, in the state of Alaska, we have a registry for the adult offender. So anyone who's classified as, you know, a sex offense, almost anyone, there's of course always exceptions, goes on that registry for a certain amount of time. Up here, it's, you know, 5 to 15 years, sometimes life, mm-hmm. Depending on the level of severity of their offense and any kind of aggravators that came into play. Mm-hmm. And so typically, you know, it's their job quarterly, annually to kind of update that with the troopers. And then the troopers have, you know, in a perfect world, have their address where they're living and the place that they work and what their offense is.
And those are public.
Those are public. Yep. You can go on and just look online and Google. And I think they even have apps for people's smartphones now that kind of tell you who the sex offenders are in your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The thing that really kind of bothers me about this idea of a registry is not so much that there's a registry out there, because I think if we look at it in its context, it does help to keep the offenders accountable for their offense. And it does kind of alert the public as to kind of what's going on. But I think what happens is that people miss the bigger picture there in terms that a lot of offenses, especially offenses against children, occur with people that we know, acquaintances or family members. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is I tell my son, hey, you know, stay away from that house over there across the street because there's a sex offender living there. He's on the registry.
Right.
Which tells me, like knowing what I know because I do my work here, if they're in compliance with that registry, they likely have a probation officer they're checking with on a frequent basis. Their boss knows what their offense is. Hopefully they've been through treatment or are on the waiting list to get into treatment. So they're kind of doing everything they're supposed to be doing, as opposed to saying, hey, let me know if Uncle Jimmy puts you on his lap and you feel uncomfortable about it.
Right.
So I'm teaching, you know, my son, like this illusion of the stranger danger that we've always talked about, where I'm teaching my kid, watch out for those strangers, but don't worry about our family members when it's more likely it's going to happen there. Mm-hmm. So that's where I think we run into some philosophical issues with the registry is that mm-hmm. it can lead to prejudice and hate and a lot of misunderstanding, and then also this false sense of security, mm-hmm. which is a really big deal as a parent, I think.
So there's two big issues that caught my attention, the prejudice and hate and the false sense of security, our perceptions versus what's real.
Right.
And what I'm hearing you say and what I think I've heard before in various ways is that the most likely, at least for child sex offense, and maybe I'm wrong here, it's somebody close. It's a boyfriend. It's somebody that's in the family, it's a relative.
Right, absolutely. That is definitely the highest rate of offenses. Uh-huh. Stranger offenses, stranger and stranger offenses are not as common as I think people assume. Mm-hmm.
What about this idea of of, oh, now I'm blocking on the word. You said people prejudice, I guess is what I was trying to say. What do you mean by that specifically? What are the connotations that come to your mind when you talk about the prejudice involved in these registries?
Well, I think, people look at these registries, the first thing that pops up because they don't delineate is it says sex offender / kidnapping. And so you see this guy's picture and you can automatically assume if you don't look any further that this guy's kidnapped some little kid off of a playground when he was wearing his trench coat and, drag the kid out back. It's that whole sort of playing into the myth of the sex offender. And I think that's where we get into a lot of hatred and misunderstanding and ignorance. When in reality, a great deal of the guys that I work with, perhaps have had one offense in their history, and are doing what they need to do to recognize what their cycle is and how not to fall back into that cycle and set up a safety net and do the next right thing and the next right thing. And, sometimes that registry can hold them back, from getting a job, especially if they were juveniles, from completing school. And then that just sort of puts them then into a marginalized sort of society, like what we see maybe in California or Florida, where, that you have groups of sex offenders who've been adjudicated on whatever kind of charge, living under bridges because they can't live so many feet from a school zone or, things like that. So they become a marginalized society.
Mm-hmm. Which, it seems to me, increases the likelihood of more judicial or legal interaction in their lives.
Yeah, you would think so. I mean, if they can't get their needs met, through normal means.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let me remind listeners again, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Michelle Martin, who's a licensed professional counselor, deals to a large degree, if not primarily, with the treatment of adolescent and juvenile sex offenders and the victims. If you've got questions or comments about this particular issue while you're listening today, you can call us directly during the next 45 minutes or so at 550-8433. Our email address is line1, and you spell that out, LINEONE, at alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number for those who need that, 1-888-353-5752. So paint me, if you can, a mental image of a composite of the most common kind of sexual offender that you're dealing with, then. Is that possible?
I think that would be a challenge. I see a lot of different types of offenders, and obviously they all kind of got there in different ways. They all have their own specific pathways that brought them to committing this offense, the eye of the storm, if you will. Could describe, a child pornography, maybe somebody who came into my office with having looked or distributed child pornography, they typically will come in and have a lower what normal people would call self-esteem, not as many coping skills in place as maybe a healthy functioning person who hasn't been adjudicated on this. I think porn is one of those things too, that pornography that people don't typically discuss a lot. But is so readily available and easy to get, especially with our social media and the internet now, that it becomes more and more challenging for people to kind of not fall down that slippery slope of looking for something, pictures a little bit more exciting until they find themselves into this realm of child pornography. And that can be really challenging to let go of that too. So with the gentlemen who maybe are females who have had an offense against a minor, they're a lot more soft-spoken, not somebody you would pick off a street as being a person who you would be worried about or concerned about. And then all the way to the other end of the scale of the people who commit like the sexual assaults, maybe in the first degree or second degree. A little bit tougher in their presentation, a little bit stronger in the way they sort of verbalize things or talk about things, but still very much everybody kind of has this different sort of dysfunctional pathway that led them to committing their offense. And so the art of it is kind of picking that out as you interview them and talk to them and work with them. What were your risk factors that brought you kind of to this point in your life where this was the solution to whatever problems you had going on?
I've been somewhat fascinated in the amount of spare time that I have about what we're learning about the neuropsychology, the neurobiology of our brains, which is really accelerating. And I like to immediately think now of a lot of what we do is setting up true neural hardwired circuits. I use the example in talking with patients sometimes is that you learn how to ride a bike, but it's very hard to unlearn how to ride a bike because it's very hardwired. And some of what you were saying there makes me think, because this is the way I think, that this is almost like an addiction. And I think of addiction as almost like you've got this hardwired physical part of your brain that's just been reinforced over and over for various reasons to do this, and that it's like trying to change an addiction because of what the words you used in describing what was going on is that people may be exposed to certain situations through a porn or whatever that gets them back into this cycle of doing things. It almost sounds like a person who's addicted to heroin or something getting exposed to heroin again. Do you think of it in that way, or am I way out there?
You're not. I don't think you're way out there. I think, you know, this is obviously a field that's very much in its infancy. And so the etiology of offending has been, you know, there's all, you know, across the gamut kind of people trying to guess at why it happens and how it happens and, you know, if there's a pill to take care of it. I mean, so neuropsychology definitely is coming into starting to play a bigger piece in that. And there's people who are studying that and looking at that and very intrigued by that. And I think that that's probably where the answer lies, is within the neuropsychology. I hesitate to use the word addiction because working with the gentleman, you know, if they can find something like that, that's sort of a lifeline, so to speak, like I'm going to go to, you know, Sexual Addiction Anonymous, or, you know, we talk about some of the bigger stars that we've heard of who sort of say they have sexual addiction. You know, there's there's this whole myth, I think, out there about sexual addiction. I'm going to get myself into trouble, I'm sure of it. I start getting some people calling in about this. But I think there's a I think there's a large myth about sexual addiction. I think that what we're doing is looking for a lifeline. We're looking for an excuse to explain behaviors that we're choosing to do rather than looking at what led us to these choices and then making some changes in that.
So I'm interested then in the psychology. I guess what I'm trying to say is how does someone get started in this way? Does it have to do with their own sexuality? Does it have to do with dominance? Does it have to do with self-esteem, personal home experience? What leads them? All of the above?
I think it is all of the above. I was trying to remember everything you're saying so I could sort of address each point. But I think, you know, if I look at sort of, you know, let's say a guy comes into my office and he wants an assessment. He's been sent by his probation officer. He wants an assessment done to see whether or not he needs treatment. The first thing we'll do is we'll talk about what it was like growing up in his house. Mom and dad, were they together? Were they married? Was there domestic violence in the home? Was there substance abuse? Did anyone use drugs? You know, things like that. Because that right there kind of starts to then sort of point at that neuropsychology issue we were talking about before. Is this sort of a genetic thing that's been passed on in some way, shape, or form? You know, was mom bipolar? Was mom very angry all the time? Did mom use substances, which gives me a clue that mom was trying to have that as a coping skill to cover something else or deal with something else? So I kind of look at that, you know, dysfunctional family of origin issues. And then the next step is to kind of talk about school. What was school like for them? Did they have friends? Did they make friends? Were they teased a lot? What part in that teasing did they have? You know, were they bullies themselves? How old were they the first time they discovered pornography, you know, or were exposed to sexual acts in the home or among friends? And so we can kind of start looking at this, you know, when we talk about pathways, kind of start looking at what the direction was and how it started. And we can say, you know, did they have special education in school? Did they find school challenging? Did they even finish school? Did they hop around from job to job? Did they hop around from girlfriend or boyfriend, you know, relationship to relationship? Risky behaviors, risky sort of, you know, jobs like that they could take that would give them a little bit of a rush, things like that. And then their own sort of substance abuse and drug or, you know, drug use. And then typically then what that leads to is, you know, financial difficulties in their marriages or relationships, And then, you know, multiple unresolved issues in those relationships, and then they're going to start looking outward to other things to sort of buoy them up or support them. And that's when kind of they start, you know, they can make a choice to keep going forward and making the next right decision, the next responsible decision, like, you know, some of us do. I'm going to pay that bill, or I'm going to cut off my pornography use because I see it's hurting my wife's feelings, or, you know, those types of things, as opposed to maybe somebody who makes a different choice and says, I'm going to ignore paying that bill, and I'm going to get very anxious about it, so I'm going to go look at some more porn, or, you know, things like that. So it's just a very slippery slope, I think. And then you talk about this idea of self-esteem, and I think a lot of the people that I work with, their access to personality disorders, things like that, self-esteem isn't necessarily what they're lacking, because what they have is other esteem. They're getting their esteem from reactions from other people, from the attention of other people, and they really don't even have their own sort of sense of self at all.
Hmm.
I don't know if that big long-winded answer.
Tell me a little bit about that last part. That's something I don't recall ever having heard again. So they're seeking the attention of others because...
Right, because it buoys them up. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. If we want to go back to the very beginning of this conversation where you're talking about sexting, mm-hmm. And maybe a girl sends a picture of herself, a provocative picture of herself mm-hmm. to her boyfriend, you know, partly because she wants the attention, she wants the reaction,
gotcha.
That type of thing, mm-hmm. That doesn't have anything to do with self-esteem. She's not building a sense of herself. She's determining who mm-hmm. she is based on the reactions of others.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of what I see with a lot of the men that come in, is that they're building their sense of self based on the reaction of other people and that type of thing.
You mentioned something about, for example, that men may come in and are sent in, and the idea is, are they appropriate for treatment? What do you mean there, if I'm remembering what you said correctly? So
sure.
are there people that clearly are not going to be remediable or not appropriate? Or?
Sure. You know, I mean, if we typically... if someone's coming out of incarceration, they're on probation or parole. Their probation officer, they usually have a mandatory requirement as part of their, you know, probation or parole requirements to get an assessment to determine if they're, you know, if they should do treatment or not do treatment. And so they'll come in and they'll meet with one of the providers in town, the approved providers in town, and they, you know, in order to be amenable to treatment, you know, they kind of have to want to be there. I mean, nobody really wants to have to go to sex offender treatment, but they need to have 100% or ish, you know, they have to have substantial agreement with the investigation and what the victim said, because that's really the only time the victim gets a voice in this whole judicial process. So they need to say, you know, she said I did this, this, and this. I did this, this, and this. And then talking about kind of what they think may have led to the offense and things like that, and then they're determined amenable. If they completely deny the offense altogether and say, I didn't do that, or it was consensual, or she's a liar, or they kind of pick things apart here and there, they're typically not considered amenable for treatment, and then we have a different path that they'll go through.
Which is?
Typically, they'll go into a deniers group
mm-hmm.
Where they'll have... It's a period of time where they meet a couple nights a week, and they have other offenders come in who were in denial and then decided to kind of let that denial go and move through the treatment process and are doing better on the other end because of that. So they'll hear their stories, and they'll work with an approved provider and a probation officer and kind of coming to terms with maybe obtaining substantial agreement with their pre-sentence investigation. So,
mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they'll go back to jail.
If they're not willing to try to move ahead, they
Correct.
Might go back to jail. I mean,
Correct.
So there's a big incentive to say, oh, yeah, I'll admit to it. I
right.
did it, right?
Right. And you'll definitely get guys who will go through the motions and act like,
yeah,
you know, oh,
right.
yeah, whatever you say.
Right.
But it's
right.
pretty easy to read when they're
yeah.
doing that.
All right.
Because their actions don't equate to their words,
mm-hmm.
right? So.
Mm-hmm. Remind our listeners again, we're discussing the adult and juvenile sex offenders, and a little bit about the psychology and the origins of this behavior. If you've got questions or comments, it'd be nice to hear from you. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. In general, I think it's from what I know of talking to psychologists and counselors in medicine, is that the likelihood of a successful treatment is very much dependent on the willingness of the person to buy into the diagnosis and accept the ideas that are being espoused about treatment. For example, if someone does not believe in medical care and the way medical care is practiced in the United States, it's very unlikely I'm going to get anywhere with that individual, or if they're very much against the idea of medicine. So is that generally true also about what you do, is that they have to be willing to accept the fact that they've got a problem and that they want to get fixed or helped? Let me put it that way. That maybe may not be the right word.
Delineate that.
Yeah.
This is a tough thing, because I do think, I mean, I would say probably 99% of the men and women who walk through my door don't think they need help. They think they got it all covered. They think they can handle it. They certainly don't want to have to sit in a group with other people who have offended and listen to these stories and have to talk about their own story. So I think, you know, for the most part, all of them start off kind of anxious and not wanting to necessarily talk about this stuff. And so I don't think that it's necessarily the same way as a standard, you know, like what we think of as standard psychology, you know, like, you know, people who go in and I'm going to buy into my diagnosis and I'm going to do all the work towards that and I'm going to feel better on the other end of it. This is very different, really, about kind of teaching and role modeling and having them learn new skills. And they're rarely ever willing to do that from the get-go. So it's all about sort of building relationships
and having
respect. So
they often don't accept the fact that they've got a problem?
Or they think, you know, oh yeah, this happened to me, but it was because I was drunk. It was because I was high. It was because she was being a terrible person, you know, things like this, kind of putting that outward blame on other people instead of taking on that onus of responsibility. So it's a lot about, and that's, I think, where the grace comes in, of affording them respect when they come in and, you know, not treating them like they're pariahs and beating them about the head and neck with this offense, but rather just working with them to figure out, you know, how they got there. So once you kind of get them engaged in treatment, there's a little bit of art in that. But once they're engaged in treatment, you know, for the most part, I think a lot of them are very successful in managing that. You know, because we use this word treatment, and with that comes all this connotation of treatment fixed, right? Treatment, they're going to be better. Treatment, this isn't going to happen again. But in reality, what we're doing is just teaching them how to manage themselves. And because this is not going to just be a one-shot deal, this is going to be the rest of their lives that they're going to have to figure out how to manage themselves and recognize when they're in periods of stress and surround themselves with people who can say, I'm noticing you're stressed out. I don't see you noticing that. What are you going to do about it? You know, so a safety net of sorts. So it's more about management than treatment.
That's an interesting concept. It reminded me of something somebody said to me when I was in medical school. We may come back to that. But what I do need to do is I need to take a break right now.
Sure.
Michelle, and I know we have a listener who's call is holding for a call, so we'll take that as soon as we get back. Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and we'll rejoin our guest, Anchorage counselor, Michelle Martin. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line One, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line One, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and my guest today is Anchorage licensed professional counselor Michelle Martin, very close to a PhD, and I'm proud of her. Happy for her. Also probably proud that she can stick with that kind of long-term work while she's working at the same time. You can email questions today about the psychology and treatment of adult and juvenile sex offenders to our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us directly. We'll be here about another 25 minutes at 550-8433. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on a Monday evening, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, so we won't be able to take your call. You can also always go to alaskapublic.org and get the link for Line 1 and listen to past broadcasts at any time. They are there for your listening pleasure. Let's go ahead and take our caller. Robert, you're on Line 1. What can we do for you? Yep, I guess he dropped off. It looked like there was a question perhaps about scenarios with false charges, and I saw that on the list of questions, and it seems inevitable that the issue will come up about people who may have been falsely accused. How often is that happening? How often do people who've already been convicted continue to say that? How much do you worry about that as a reality?
Well, I think, you know, if they're coming into treatment, then they're not in the middle of an appeals process. If they're still appealing their convictions, they need to focus on that. So, you know, and I think it does happen. It's one of the downfalls, obviously, you know, of a system. But I think that, you know, they have the opportunity to be able to work on that. And they also have an opportunity during sentencing to be able to go back and argue whatever points of the pre-sentence investigation they don't agree with and have that changed and altered and things like that. So.
As a pediatrician who's at times been involved in some of the accusations of sexual abuse in children, I know it can be extremely difficult, despite the fact that we've gotten better and better at evaluating children and making sure we've got the right evidence. It still can be very much a he said, you said kind of situation.
Definitely, yeah. And you have to have somebody who's a good forensic interviewer who's been trained in that so that you don't run those risks either of saying, you know, perhaps the interviewer or therapist kind of put words in the child's mouth,
yep.
Things like that. So it's a very tricky business.
It's very difficult.
And not wanting to re-victimize the victim all over again either with that process.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've got an email, a couple of sentences long. Stick with me. I think we need to read the whole thing. It says, my daughter was sexually assaulted when she was 17 by a boy she knew who was 19 years old at a party. She and a group of other kids were sleeping over, and the assault happened while she was asleep. Until she woke up and managed to get away from him. My husband and I didn't find out about it until recently. I would like to know if it's too late for her to press charges. This was 2 months ago. We also found out that this young man, now about 21, has assaulted other girls in this group of high school friends in the past. My daughter would like to press charges, but is out of state at college. Can she do it from there, or does she have to be here, or can we do it?
So some of these, obviously, I'm not, you know, an attorney or a detective, but I can say from my experience, 2 months, definitely you can still report. And I do think that if your daughter is feeling like this is a strong enough issue, then I do think it's very important for her to report it. You know, people talk about that, you know, girls passing out at parties, maybe girls falling asleep at parties and being sexually assaulted while asleep or drunk or on some type of ecstasy or something that was, you know, I think roofies have been a big thing, and sort of teaching your daughters kind of the safety around not accepting drinks from men at parties or bars or things like that. I mean, even as we get older, you know, we have to learn how to not do that stuff and to really pay attention to our surroundings at all time and have our buddy with us, our safety buddy, who's going to make sure we get home and don't pass out. But, you know, even if, I mean, we're talking about the definition of legal consent here. If she was asleep or you have someone who, for instance, was intoxicated at a party, neither one of them can give legal consent. So it is a sexual assault. So, yes, I would encourage them to make the report. Even from out of state, she can make the report.
Okay. Let's take another phone call, and this call is coming in from Unalaska. So there is, for Augie, for you that's calling, and for us here, there's a small delay due to the fact that we're a long way away, but what can we do for you?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have, my subject of concern is that when sexual offenders who have a SAM charge, a sexual abuse of a minor, and they decide to do flat time rather than go to treatment or whatever you want to call it while incarcerated. So then they are served their sentence and they're free, and they, of course, have to register as a sex offender. But when involved in a OCS case, child protective case, you know, in the past when I worked this work, it was really very, very difficult to find any way to fund a program that's approved by the state to help address or complete the program or graduate from it or whatever you want to say so that you could no longer have the limitations on your visitation or custody.
Yeah, Augie, it seems to me what you're saying there at the end especially is that for people who may have been convicted, they need to finish some treatment, and yet it was very difficult to find that opportunity. Is that what you're saying?
Not only the opportunity, but a form of funding when people don't have any money. It's a catch-22.
Ah, I got you. Yeah. You can't
afford services.
Yeah, you can't afford to get the services that are required of you.
And I can speak to that just briefly.
Right.
Is you know, when they do flat time, typically they'll come out, and that means that they don't have any time held over their head. And they're perhaps no longer even on paper, which means that they don't have the probation or parole requirements anymore. But OCS puts then sort of a parenting plan in place that says that you have to complete treatment before you can have contact with your children. I'm hoping that's what you're talking about. I've had to work with that quite a bit. And, you know, I know for myself, you know, we have a handful of approved providers here in the state. And I think almost every single one of the approved providers now does a sliding scale. So, I mean, I know for myself personally, I'll work with people who don't have the money to be able to pay for treatment if they're requesting treatment and if it's something that they're being required to do by some type of agency or just because they want to do it. Because I do feel like this is an important thing to make sure that we offer that to people despite, you know, their ability to pay. The one thing I think you run into, though, especially being from like Unalaska or some of the other villages, is that we don't necessarily have treatment providers that are close by. So they'll have to fly into Fairbanks or Anchorage or Juneau. One way that I think the state is trying to beef this up a little bit, they've opened a treatment program. I mean, at one point we had a treatment program at Highland Mountain Meadow Creek that was shut down, and that's been gone for, you know, 10, 15 years now. And so they've opened up a treatment program now down at in Juneau Prison at Lemon Creek, and they're about to open another program out in the Palmer Correctional Center. So we're going to be offering some more treatment programs while they're institutionalized. And then, you know, I know that the state is trying to get more approved providers on board. There's quite a lot of hoops you have to jump through in order to become an approved provider and extra education. It's really a very specialized field. So I think, you know, not everybody's called to working with sex offenders either. So it's, you know, you got to find somebody who's interested and then find somebody who's willing to go through all the time and the extra additional contact hours and supervision hours and things like that that come along with this. But I do think that the state's trying to put things into place. I do think, though, that you run the risk of having some challenges when you're out in the villages. And, you know, we just started doing some – I've just personally started doing some telehealth with a couple of people out in various villages who were convicted of sexual offenses and don't want to have to leave their village in order to come in to get treatment. So we'll do treatment via telehealth. And so, you know, I think there are some things on the horizon that are going to support this type of stuff that you're talking about right now.
Yeah, and I guess the second part of that is a great concern, because people leaving the village who have nothing, you know, it's very difficult, as we all know, and their support services, like family and people, are not there. The other thing is that I find it very difficult. A lot of times these cases age out, if you want to know. Not age out in the children, but they have to move along. And if the people in the case, the child custody case, don't get things done in a timely manner or refuse to cooperate, the children are adopted out. So, that, you know, we hate to see this happen, but it does.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, thanks, Augie, for calling. I think you pointed out some problems. No easy answers there. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Bye.
What about the question of success of therapy and how is that measured? Do we know what kinds of therapies work best? And I suspect it'll depend on the patient or the client, as you might say, and the success that we might expect as we address this.
Well, I think, you know, you talk about the types of therapy. I mean, the gold standard is cognitive behavioral therapy when working with offenders. And then, you know, we've also been working with something called the Good Lives Model. So, you know, basically boiled down into a nutshell, if we're saying no to something, like, no, you can't look at this pornography, what can we say yes to? What can we offer instead of? Which makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, there's different ways that people obviously work with offenders and lots of discussion. But like I said before, it's in such, you know, the treatment is in such its infancy stage that I don't think that that we really have kind of the perfect way to do treatment. That being said, I do think that the success actually depends on the client coming into the office and how willing they are to really look at their risk factors, utilize their safety net as they set it up, and utilize their relapse prevention plan.
I have an addendum to the previous question that I got by email about the boy who assaulted a 17-year-old girl. He was 19 at the time, and this was 2 months ago or so. Another question comes in from the same writer: is what was likely to happen to them, to the young man, if they go ahead and press charges? We are mainly interested in the assault being on its record, is the point. So what would happen, in a sense, once this charge is pressed, I guess?
Sure. You know, this is going to be very challenging for me to speak to just because I'm not an attorney, not a district attorney.
Right.
Obviously, you know, charges are filed, an investigation happens, charges are filed, they're sent to the DA, and then, you know, it kind of goes from there. A lot of times what will happen is that they'll plead it down to a lesser charge, but they'll have a charge on their record nonetheless. So I do think that especially if this particular situation, if they were to come forward and give, that would give the freedom to the other girls to also come forward, that they probably got a pretty good case to at least get some charges on his record, definitely.
Another question I had written down I'd like to pursue is that, again, back to the psychology of people convicted of sexual offenses. In a typical case, again, and I know that that's difficult, but I'm trying to be more general in how this relates to different people, and it may not be so generalizable, but do sex offenders in general have a history of being a victim of sexual abuse themselves, or physical abuse more so than the normal population?
I think that's always been an assumption, something that we've always thought. Like if they're abusing, it's because they were abused as kids. And a large study and several other studies have been done that show that it's perhaps maybe one third in actuality of people who are abused also abused. So it's less than what we think. I think far, far less. Not every offender has been offended against.
And this is another question, which, you know, again, it comes from my medical background and thinking about prevention. And I would guess this is probably no, but can the risk of a person being, can we predict the risk of a person being at risk of doing sexually offending activities?
Wouldn't that be amazing if we could, though?
Yeah.
But no, I don't think we can predict. I mean, there's so many.
So some people can have all the risk factors that you see and not have any problems.
Absolutely.
And others may not have any of them, is what we're saying. And so it's very difficult to,
right,
to do
exactly,
that.
Exactly. So, you know, and I mean, I think before you had talked about, you know, whether this was about sexuality or control. Mm-hmm. Not sure if those are the exact words you used, but it's kind of the gist of it. But I definitely think that sexual abuse and the sexual abuse issue has a lot to do with control, different layers of control. It's not just excess sexual behavior. You know, it's not just that they aren't getting enough of what they need in that area. It's that they need to be able to control something or someone in a way that's not in that person's best interest. So
this is maybe way off the cuff, but as you said that control issue, it came to my mind that there's been some recent, I think, literature coming out of the psychology area that one of the most important things that predicts success, and again, the problem is how we're going to predict success for adults is their ability to, in a sense, self-control and an ability to delay gratification in that kind of sense. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Does it have anything to do with what we're talking about
today?
Right,
and I think so. I mean, you know, it's a matter of being able to, you know, stop those thoughts when they come up and find other coping skills to put in place and then be willing to use those skills rather than just go back to the deviant sexual behavior that they've done for so long.
Which gets back to your idea of giving them other things. They have to figure out other ways to, what was managed this thought process that they have, giving them another outlet, not to fall back into old habits,
right?
Not get exposed to the situations that might trigger.
Precisely. Yep. Exactly. Stay away from those situations and utilize their safety nets.
So let's talk just briefly. We only have about 10 minutes left about the victims a little bit.
Okay.
What can you say? What is the most important thing you want to get across to us that are listeners about treatment of people who are have been the victim of some sexual offense?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that a sexual offense isn't necessarily, you know, when you're working with a victim, and I think there's a lot of people out there who feel like if you work with the offenders, you can't work with the victims, and it's very much the opposite. I mean, I have a very unique perspective of the offender, having worked with them, which I think also helps me with my work with victims, because it's not just about the sexual abuse that has occurred. It's about all the manipulations that took place in addition to that, and it's kind of trying to flesh out those manipulations and be able to show them to the victim so that the victim can truly understand that they were not at fault. I think that's going to be the biggest challenge, is to get them to a place where they truly understand that this was not their fault.
So there's the inevitable guilt that we seem to keep coming back to, which I guess seems a little surprising to me. I'm thinking again that it's mainly men perpetrating on girls or women.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a hard time understanding why a woman would feel so much guilt about that. But maybe that's just the way human nature is. I deal with a lot of women who are mothers, and they often feel guilty about what's going on. And I'm trying to, no, it's not your fault. So I guess it's the same thing,
right? And it's easy to say it's not your fault, but I think, you know, speaking as a woman, I mean, you know, it's challenging not to second guess. I think for victims, it's hard not to second guess yourself. Like maybe, and especially with the stuff, you know, the information we get from the media too. Maybe if I wasn't wearing that particular outfit, maybe if I didn't walk into that alleyway by myself, you know, maybe if I wasn't alone in the grocery store parking lot, you know, I mean, you second guess yourself as you would with any sort of traumatic event.
Mm-hmm.
And and I think also, you know, what we talked about earlier in the program about most of us know who our offenders are. So you're going to get, you know, the women who acquaintance rape or something happens to them at a party, things like that. I mean, they're, of course, going to say, you know, why didn't I see the signs? The manipulations were so subtle. And I think that's how they're so skillful at what they do. And then this is also something that very much happens in secrecy and isolation. And the offender set it up that way. So it's challenging to come forward and talk about it. It's challenging to tell people unless you're, you know, already very strong or very, you know, hurt enough that you've been taken to a hospital and somebody has to make the report for you. So so I think we get into this idea of, again, the control issue. You know, the offender knows that this person is more than likely going to take on that onus of responsibility and carry the ball, so to speak, for the offender, so the offender doesn't have to take responsibility for it.
What are some of the potential or real long-term effects on the victims? I guess what I'm specifically asking about is how often, what is post-traumatic stress as it relates to this? Is that the most common thing that you worry about? Can we prevent that kind of long-term outcome?
Sure. I think, you know, that sexually, you know, the people who have been sexually abused, I mean, long-term, we see all kinds of things, PTSD, you know, bad dreams, a mistrust maybe in the sex, you know, low self-esteem, difficulty in school. I mean, it runs kind of across the board. We see, you know, if we're speaking of sort of the typical what everybody thinks, man against woman, sexual assault, you know, the female would feel powerlessness. She'd be stigmatized for being sexually assaulted. She'd be, you know, traumatically, I mean, her sexualization is traumatized at that point as well. And so I think, you know, we're talking long-term effects for people who have been sexually assaulted. And what was the second half of your question? If you,
I don't even remember here. What was I? We were talking about the.
I mean, if you know, if we're working with victims, we want to show them what's sort of appropriate and normal sexuality, what's appropriate, right, and normal and healthy, and then slowly, you know, one by one, kind of remove all of these manipulations that have been put into them, especially when you're working with a kid who maybe has been an incest survivor or a sexual assault against a minor victim, something like that, because those are the ones that are kind of more long-term and definitely more sort of insidious with the way that the offender kind of breaks his way in and breaks down these walls in order to have this offense happen.
In your mind, is there a greater degree of seriousness to perhaps incest or pedophiles as opposed to date rape and some of these things, or is it really all boiled down to the same risk factors for both the perpetrator and the victim?
Well, I think every perpetrator has different risk factors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can't boil it all down. If you're talking about like level of seriousness, like, well, date rape's not that big of a deal,
yeah,
but sexual assault or pedophilia is. I really, you know, disagree with that. I think along the range that, you know, obviously there's a range of deviant sexual interests,
right,
but
right,
sexual assault of any kind definitely falls on the far end.
It's harm.
And control.
I hadn't thought about that, but the more you were talking, it made me think about the fact that it does may have the same consequences.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it pulls out that autonomy. I mean, if we're talking about a date rape, you know, here's a young woman, perhaps 22, 23, goes out with somebody that her friends all said was great. You know, he's very popular at the school. She gets sexually assaulted. She can't tell anyone. Sure feels like she can't tell anyone, right, because, you know, they're going to think she's the liar. Or, I mean, so we're talking about, you know, this whole, then that opens up this whole host of issues, you know. Well, he's not holding any of the burden of responsibility for his actions. So,
we haven't talked about women very much, so let's don't let them off the hook. There are women, you said, that are have been convicted of sexual offense. What is there important differences here or not?
I think the biggest difference that I've noticed in working with the females out at Highland versus working with the males is that things are more on a relationship basis. It's more about you know, being in a relationship that's not satisfying and seeking out something else, or developing a relationship with their victim, things like that. So there's more sort of a relational aspect to their offending, mm-hmm, than might be with the...
Which seems to be, and generally what I hear about the way men and women might look at sex,
right,
differently.
Yeah,
is
right,
it true?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So women may form relationships with illegal minors, is what you're
right,
saying.
Right, right. Yeah, you would think about, you know, like the Mary-Kate Letourneau. Everybody knows the Mary-Kate, mm-hmm, Letourneau story, right? So, mm-hmm, you know, a female teacher who has sexual intercourse with her student, and kind of how does that work, and how do they break down those boundaries and make it seem like it's okay, or perhaps even the victim's idea.
So maybe there are parents listening out there who have questions about normal sexual activity, normal exploration in preschools, child school age, and even adolescence, that maybe we should try to address briefly in the last couple of minutes, so
you know,
I can give them some reassurance or worry.
Definitely, I think the risk of talking about sexual offending and looking at all sort of this big negative black cloud is that we miss the idea that there's such beauty and grace in healthy, sexually intimate relationships. And so I think, you know, it's it's kind of teaching our kids then that what intimacy really is. Intimacy isn't just about sexual terms, but it's all the different ways people can be together, you know, sharing in the raising of children and finances, politics, religion. It's all the positive and relational parts of sexual intimacy, and it's a good opportunity at any developmental age to talk to your child about it and kind of hone it to them. And I think not just that one initial birds and bees talk where the kid's jaw drops to the counter, but following that up, you know, and checking in when they get into high school and start, you know, practicing at these intimate relationships and checking in about, you know, whether there's domestic violence present, whether there's pressure that they're not comfortable with, you know, how they're feeling about their body and how they're kind of exploring, you know, what that's going to look like and who they're going to be. And especially with girls coming into their own sort of femininity and practicing with what they're wearing and how they're talking and how they're flirting and things like that. Like, those are all good opportunities and teachable moments to talk to your kids about how to sort of have those sexual boundaries, like what we were discussing.
The Academy of Pediatrics likes to also talk about the effects of media and how media can persuade or encourage behaviors. Do you often bring that kind of issue up when you're talking to your son, if he's old enough, or other
kids? Oh, my poor son, he's in trouble. I think, you know, definitely we see the kids on the television. I mean, even on the Nick channels and the things that are supposed to be sort of wholesome, we definitely see those kids as more sexualized. The videos, I mean, I think the biggest one that comes to mind is Britney Spears. You know, some of those videos that we see where she's very sexualized, dressed like a little girl with a lollipop in her mouth and things like that. And I think, you know, that's the time to sort of talk about what, you know, sex versus intimacy, closeness, affection, love, and how sometimes the media can take that and distort it into something else. And they can spoil something that is intended to be very positive and make it kind of negative and unpleasant. So it's kind of educating our kids on all the values that are associated with sexuality and what we want to see in that.
All right. Well, thanks very much. It's been enjoyable. I'm glad we finally got around to something like this. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize people like you existed out there. So there's more than one of you that's doing this kind of thing.
I think there's five of us in Anchorage now, yeah.
All right. So my guest today has been Anchorage, the licensed practice professional counselor, Michelle Martin. And I want to say my personal thanks again. And if you want to continue today's conversation, you can join us on KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website. Next week, September 24th, our guests are going to be two kind of national medical heavyweights, Dr. Otis Brawley, who's the chief medical officer for the American Cancer Society, and Dr. Gilbert Welch of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Research are going to be my guests. Dr. Welch is also the author of Overdiagnosed, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health. And we're going to be discussing the evidence and logic about some of the recent changes and recommendations for mammograms and screening for breast cancer and prostate cancer screening. The overall arching question is, when is screening for disease, particularly in healthy people, not a good idea? Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. She helped with phone calls and emails today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.